and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 6th, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. From the front page of today's Gazette, no patient should have to pass alone. Nurse offers care, compassion as coronavirus deaths worsen. By Vanessa Miller of the Gazette in Iowa City. No one should die alone, so Nick Klein stayed. For hours by the bed of one of his first COVID-19 patients, the 31-year-old University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics nurse sat and held the patient's hand. He played music. He didn't know what to say. So I was just present, Klein told the Gazette. I think presence says a lot. Even after months of sitting by COVID-19 patient bedsides, holding phones so family members can say goodbye, squeezing hands and listening for last breaths, Klein said he still doesn't have the right words. Presence has been something that I've kind of leaned on, he said. I simply held their hand and just reassured them their family loves them. Klein is among hundreds of UIHC nurses who, day in and day out since March, have tied on gown after gown, mask after mask, and scrubbed their hands raw caring for patients suffering from a virus that leaves some people unfazed and others fighting for every breath. For 3 years, Klein has worked in the UIHC Medical Intensive Care Unit, home to 26 of the campus's now 228 ICU beds. Before recently converting 10 more beds for intensive care patients as part of its COVID-19 surge plan, UIHC had 5 adult ICU units with a total of 103 beds and 2 in the Stead Family Children's Hospital with 115 pediatric beds. The campus, like thousands of other healthcare centers nationally, has been scrambling for enough nurses to handle spikes in COVID-19 patients. As of September 30th, it had 3,231 registered nurses, including 414 in its ICUs. Of that total, 312, including Klein, are in adult ICUs and on the front lines of the response to the pandemic, which has grown exponentially worse this fall. Iowa confirmed another 62 COVID-19 deaths Saturday morning, bringing the total in Iowa since the beginning of the pandemic to 2,665. In just the first days of this month, the state has confirmed 262 COVID-19 deaths, including 2 days in a row of record-setting death tolls from the disease. Statewide COVID-19 hospitalizations, which hadn't topped 600 until October 29th, saw a sharp spike in November, surging to 1,527 nearly 3 weeks later on November 18th. They have dropped since, but still remain far higher than the peak of last summer's surge. UIHC's coronavirus inpatient count started in November around 30 and soared to a peak of 91 on November 20th, representing a 65% spike from a week earlier when UIHC reported 55 inpatients. Although the campus's COVID-19 inpatient total last week dropped back into the 50s, Klein said he has experienced no letup since summer. It was kind of after the 4th of July that we started seeing more cases come to our unit, he said, and it really hasn't slowed down. He's seen patients young and old, with and without pre-existing conditions, cycle through his space, sometimes needing ventilators, other times therapeutic medicine, but often desperate for oxygen and hope. I can't imagine what the patients and family are going through firsthand, Klein said, despite his intimate view of their struggles. I can't really put myself in their shoes or go through what they're going through. In trying, though, Klein has found himself compelled to shepherd those destined to die on his watch through the experience of passing, if no one else can. It's just kind of been my philosophy as a nurse, even before the pandemic, that no patient should have to pass alone, he said, thinking back to the first COVID-19 patient lost in April on his watch. I ended up sitting with this patient for a couple of hours while they passed, he said. That's something I'd done before the pandemic, but this was just so much tougher. I don't even know if I can really describe it, hearing somebody say their goodbyes through a phone. Hospital visitors for all patients, not just those with COVID-19, have varied and shifted across the state and throughout the pandemic as hospitalizations ebbed and flowed. Caregivers learned more about the virus. Facilities shored up protective equipment and gained experience with the disease. Although UIHC for months prohibited COVID-19 patients from receiving visitors, it has updated its policy to accommodate a visitor for hospitalized patients with COVID-19, according to spokeswoman Laura Shoemaker. We recognize many patients benefit from having a loved one present to provide comfort and help with the recovery process, and patients with COVID-19 are no different, according to a UIHC statement. For added protection, visitors are required to follow strict safety protocols, including wearing appropriate personal protective equipment, limiting the length of visits, and exiting the building immediately following their visit. Klein noted the import of those allowances. We do our best to get family there, he said, because we know family presence is one of the biggest things to patient healing and to family healing. But earlier in the pandemic, nurses like Klein often had just a phone to connect families with those they were losing. That's what made the death really hard, he said. They were all alone. Klein said that he's seen plenty of death already in his 6 total years as an ICU nurse, graduating from Kirkwood Community College with a nursing degree in 2014, after an advisor steered him in that direction as a high schooler interested in medicine. It's part of being a nurse, he said. You're going to have to deal with death. But this has been different in its scale and intimacy. One patient he sat with was the same age as his mom. I kept thinking to myself, what if it was my mom or another family member, Klein said. I couldn't imagine them passing away alone. That's the cruel side of this novel coronavirus. That patient knew he was dying, so Klein got the man's family on the phone and stayed with him because it broke my heart. Taking a mental toll. Even as COVID-19 procedures and routines have become more familiar, Klein and the rest of his care team is weary after months of long and emotionally draining days that have only intensified. It's hard being a healthcare worker, he said. I don't think people are understanding the mental toll it's taking on us. It's more of a challenge to leave work at work. There are definitely some nights that I do not sleep very well, he said. I am up at night thinking about my unit or thinking about something that happened or somebody who's not doing so well. What's going to happen with them? Klein said he's thankful for his fellow nurses who are with him in his anxiety, who hold the same fears and who have seen many of the same things, but he wishes more of the public had that understanding. I wish I had a camera that everybody could watch how my day is to get a more realistic view of that what COVID can do to you, he said. Then I think we'd see more people willing to wear a mask and more people willing to stay at home and avoid social gatherings. And there's a picture of Nick Klein here, intensive care unit nurse Nick Klein. He's standing outside the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital in light green scrubs. He's got a mask over his nose and face, and the University of Iowa water tower is in the background. And there's also a picture of him inside the intensive care ward, a picture that appears to be taken through a door with a glass window in it. And in addition to the face mask, he has on a plastic shield over his entire face and over his scrubs. He's wearing a plastic gown as well as gloves. So that's his PPE, his personal protective environment. Turning to inside the Cedar Rapids Gazette front page, Iowa's COVID-19 hospitalizations dropped below 1,000. That's still over twice as high as summer surge. The number of people being treated for COVID-19 in Iowa hospitals dropped below 1,000 Saturday for the first time in 17 days, but remains more than twice as high as the summer peak. According to state public health data, the total number of Iowa COVID-19 hospitalizations dropped from 1,000 to 960 in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Saturday, the first time it fell below 1,000 since November 18th. Of those, the number of patients in intensive care declined from 209 to 204, and those on ventilators dropped from 128 to 117. Despite the decline in hospitalizations, that total is far higher than the 417 peak reached May 7th during the first surge. The number of deaths the state confirmed Saturday to be caused by the coronavirus also dropped to 62, still an alarmingly high number coming after 2 record-setting days in a row. With its 688 COVID-19 deaths, November was by far Iowa's deadliest month since the pandemic began. But in just the first 5 days of December, the state has seen more than a third of that monthly toll already. Iowa has recorded 2,665 COVID-19 deaths so far. 43 counties reported the latest. Polk County added 5, and Butler, Scott, Shelby, and Woodbury counties each recorded 3. Blackhawk, Davis, Floyd, Lee, Marion, Pottawatomie, and Warren counties each added 2. Adair, Appanoose, Carroll, Cass, Chickasaw, Clay, Clinton, Delaware, Dubuque, Hamilton, Henry, Humboldt, Ida, Jefferson, Johnson, Jones, Keokuk, Kossuth, Lynn, Lyon, Marshall, Mills, Mitchell, Monona, Osceola, Palo Alto, Plymouth, Sac, Story, Union, and Winnesheek each recorded 1 death. Of the 62 deaths, 34 were of people over 80, according to the state. Iowa added 2,362 new coronavirus cases in the 24-hour period for a total so far of 242,061. The state said the number of new cases was based on 6,401 test results, with 4,039 of them coming back negative or inconclusive in the period. Of the new cases, Linn County added 123 for a total of 14,917. Johnson County added 67 cases for a total of 9,950 cases so far. Turning to the Iowa Today page, paving the way to winter, Iowa road crews prepare for the inevitable snow and ice. And there is a picture of a road crew type truck with four men in bright fluorescent jackets working. It says, before the winter cold arrives, public work crews travel Tuesday along 15th Avenue Southwest to fill potholes in Cedar Rapids. The story is written by Kat Russell of the Gazette. Despite all the curveballs 2020 has thrown already, state and local public safety officials are looking ahead, getting ready for whatever winter might bring. October 15th is designated as our official day of winter, said Craig Bargfrede, winter administrator with the Iowa Department of Transportation. That means plows are pulled out of cold storage, they're mounted on the trucks. Any maintenance that we have to do on the trucks or the plows or the blowers or the loaders, any piece of equipment that we will be using during winter operations, we have to make sure is functioning properly and installed on the trucks. The warmer months are spent stocking salt in the Iowa DOT's 101 garages throughout the state and at a handful of off-site storage facilities. This year, Bargfrede said, the state is at 103% capacity for the materials believed needed to treat Iowa's 9,500 miles of interstates and federal and state highways during the winter. So we have somewhere in the neighborhood of about 230,000 tons of capacity stored across the state, Bargfrede said. Obviously, that number fluctuates a little bit on a daily basis, but the bottom line is that we have ample capacity to cover our needs. For the past five winters, the state has used an average of 155,000 tons of salt and 31.5 million gallons of brine, a salty water mix. However, usage requirements during the past couple of winters have exceeded that average. The last couple of winter seasons, our usage has been pushing really close to 200,000 tons of salt, so we're starting to get up into that area where our usage is getting close to our overall capacity, he said. But we've never been in a situation where the Iowa DOT is out of salt. The department's maintenance garages employ 1,082 full-time equipment operators, mechanics, and supervisors. Another 600 seasonal employees are hired each winter to keep the agency's 902 trucks, 43 motor graders, 27 tow plows, and 11 heavy-duty self-propelled snowblowers on the ground. Snowplows, Bargfrede added, are equipped with an amber light that can be seen from all directions and a set of blue and white lights on the back of vehicles. So if you're approaching a vehicle that has that combination of lights, you're approaching a snowplow from the back, he said. He asked that drivers be patient when sharing the road with a snowplow and give the plows space to do their jobs. Cedar Rapids street crews began planning for the winter last year. The city generally has about 9,000 tons of salt, sand, and 10,000 gallons of brine on hand going into winter, and it can blend brine with other products as needed. The city has about 90 pieces of snow removal equipment it can deploy during significant snowfalls on the city's 75 miles of roadway. Iowa City similarly is prepared and also explains on its website when it uses sand and when it uses salt on the streets. If the temperature is below 20 degrees and not expected to rise, salt will not be effective, it says. But if the sun is shining and the temperature is 20 degrees or more and expected to remain steady or to rise, then salt would be more effective. Plowing under the wrong conditions can create a polished street surface, resulting in dangerous glare ice. The Iowa State Patrol has 330 troopers and support staff working its 15 districts across the state. The patrol's winter preparation focuses on making sure vehicles are in top shape, said Trooper Alex Dinkla, the patrol's public information officer. Each year, our vehicles go through winter maintenance where we will equip them with snow tires, check all their fluids, replace the wiper blades, and check all the batteries, he said. So everything that we recommend to the public, we want to make sure we're doing the same things. Additionally, troopers are expected to maintain a winter survival kit, water, blankets, and food in their vehicles. If you look back a couple of years ago to when Interstate 35 was shut down in the northern part of the state, we actually had troopers that were sleeping in their cars for a couple days just because they couldn't leave the interstate, Dinkla said. Keeping our roadways safe is our primary concern, he added, which is why we try to educate the public about winter weather safety, which includes giving yourself more time to get to your destination, slowing down, and leaving room between you and the car ahead of you. And also from the Iowa Today section, the Iowa Profile, no longer a tourist, Ashley Henson readies for Washington. Republican and former anchor says her communication skills will come in handy, by James Q. Lynch, the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Whenever she has visited Washington, Ashley Henson tried to see the city as a tourist. We've gone to see the Constitution, the Portrait Gallery, she said about trips she's made to the nation's capital, usually with her husband, Matt. That started to change when the Marion couple sat on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and made the decision she should run for Congress. On November 3rd, voters in Iowa's 1st District approve of that decision, and she'll be sworn in January 3rd as Republican U.S. Representative Henson. However, her work has started. Last week, Henson was in Washington for freshman orientation with other incoming members of Congress. She's hired staff for her offices in Washington and the 20-county Northeast Iowa 1st District, and Thursday received her office assignment. Before she went to Washington, Hinson was homeschooling while she was in isolation, testing positive for COVID-19. She participated in freshman orientation remotely with her sons, Max and Jax, at her side doing their schoolwork. She also used that time to prepare them for what's ahead. During her 4 years in the Iowa legislature, Hinson's family has grown accustomed to her being away during the week. "I guess you could call that a dry run for what it's like to have mom gone," she said. A couple of years ago, she did her own Facebook version of the Schoolhouse Rock video, How a Bill Becomes a Law. And I said, "You know, boys, mommy's going to go through the same thing except in Washington, D.C. and represent a few more people," Hinson said. "They think that's really cool. I think they're very excited to say, hey, my mom's in Congress." Hinson has been meeting remotely with groups in the district, as well as with other incoming members of Congress. She often is at her kitchen counter with the boys on either side of her. When they overheard her on a call about agricultural issues, they started asking about the food supply chain. "It's a real-life homeschool," Hinson said. A former television news reporter and anchor, she believes her communication skills will help her represent the 1st District, which includes not only some of Iowa's larger cities, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Dubuque, but also rural counties. Hinson thinks her skill set will help her to ask questions to do that extra little bit of digging that Iowans expect from their representatives. "I think that's where I'll be able to utilize platforms, whether it's social media and my websites, whether it looks Zooms to teletown halls. I think I'll be able to use those platforms effectively to effectively communicate that added context about why things are happening, why I'm supporting things, or why I'm not," she said. Hinson is excited to be among at least 17 Republican women who were elected in November. That will give the GOP 26 women in the House, the most the party has ever had, and double its current numbers. "I'm so proud of the other people who put their name on the ballot and stood up and fought and won," she said. "The diversity of the women in the incoming class is impressive," Hinson added, noting some have served, like her, in state houses. Some are immigrants, women of color, gun rights activists, and newcomers to elected office. During the campaign, Hinson often referred to herself as a minivan-driving mom. She believes her communication skills and willingness to go everywhere and meet with anyone helped her bridge the differences between her suburban Iowa House district and rural voters more likely to be driving pickups and sport utility vehicles. "Moms drive whatever gets the job done for their families," said Hinson, who logged more than 60,000 miles on that minivan during the campaign. "Voters," she said, "were looking for someone who's willing to work hard and who values their family and hard work." She understands that voters can be fickle. The voters who elected her had replaced a Republican with Democratic Representative Abby Finkenauer in 2018, who Hinson then beat in November. "I'm going to make sure that I'm doing what I said I would do, which is fight for taxpayers," Hinson said. "I talked a lot about issues that were really important to small businesses, to transportation and infrastructure, to families, to making it easier to have a family and providing flexibilities." Although as a Republican, she will be in the House minority, Hinson thinks those are issues where there is room for bipartisan work. "I know that there are other members who have that as a priority, both in the minority and in the majority. So there are so many issues that our district cares about that I know we'll be able to find common ground on and move forward," she said. Although Hinson will be spending her weekdays in Washington, her family will remain in Marion, where the boys attend school. Her husband is co-owner of a business in Waterloo. "I learned through my time in the Iowa House how important it was to prioritize FaceTime get-togethers at night with my family, and that's not going to change," she said. "We're a family that's going to make this work." In her previous role in television news, Hinson told stories about Northeast Iowans. "But I got tired of talking about it and wanted to do something about it. I spent the last year and a half campaigning, and now I'm ready to go to work," Hinson said. Turning to the Insight section, the Gazette's editorial, Local Focus, Cities, Counties, School Boards Deserve Local Control and Stable Funding. Local governments will welcome 2021 with all too familiar obstacles. Elected officials at the local level have complained for years about unstable funding and a lack of local control brought on by the Iowa legislature. Heading into the next legislative session, those problems are exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic and ongoing disaster recovery in eastern Iowa. Local governments need more authority to manage the pandemic, all while their revenue sources are threatened by the economic downturn. Ever since Republicans earned the state government trifecta in the 2016 elections, holding complete control over the legislative and executive branches of government, they have slowly whittled away at home rule authority. The legislature's habit of underfunding schools and social services is making it all but impossible for local governments to work through their unique circumstances. A special source of anxiety for local government budget planners is the bipartisan property tax reform bill approved in 2013. At the time, proponents of the plan said the state would backfill lost revenue to cities and counties, though legislative leaders have suggested in recent years they might phase out the payments, which would be a multi-million-dollar blow to local government's expected revenue. Representatives from city halls and courthouses also hope to claw back local governing authority, crying foul about unfunded mandates and all the red tape attached to money coming from the state. They also want more latitude over public health, the pandemic, and public safety, law enforcement reform, so they can better respond to their own unique local challenges. These are old fights rehashed under unprecedented circumstances. Maybe 2021, under pressure from a deadly infectious disease outbreak, will be different. Local government advocacy groups are finalizing their legislative priorities for the upcoming session. The Gazette reviewed draft or final versions of the legislative agendas to report some of the highlights. The Iowa Association of School Boards, representing more than 300 school boards, want adequately fund schools, including transportation and special education, fully fund preschool so all 4 and 5-year-olds have access to the voluntary preschool program, establish a comprehensive community mental health system, including greater support for in-school services. The Iowa State Association of Counties, representing all 99 county governments, want provide adequate revenue for regional mental health and disability services regions, or gives counties the ability to exceed their property tax levies. Protect the property tax backfill, whereby the state is reimbursing local governments for lost resources from statewide property tax reform. Pass a statewide sales tax increase to fund the Natural Resources Trust Fund approved by voters last decade. And the Iowa League of Cities, representing more than 800 city governments, want to preserve home rule authority where decisions are made at the local level, protect the property tax backfill, and give cities flexibility in economic development projects. The Gazette editorial board enthusiastically endorses those legislative priorities. We hope they find empathetic ears at the Capitol in January. Now more than ever, it's imperative to give local governments ample flexibility and predictable funding streams. The era of top-down government under one-party control has created a mess for local governments. Compared to the state legislature, where just 150 people account for more than 3 million Iowans, local governments are more responsive to the people they serve. Local government is where regular citizens can participate in meetings and where dissatisfied contingents can occasionally right the wrongs of the ballot box. Iowa lawmakers should not be afraid of giving power back to the people. Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Doorman, fewer impaired waters, but impaired leadership remains. So Iowa's new impaired waters list came out this past week. It's chock full of buts. Some will proclaim progress, but that's not necessarily true. There are fewer waters on the new impaired list compared to 2018, with 99 lakes, rivers, river segments, streams, and reservoirs removed from the 2020 list. But of those 99, 61 were removed not because they're no longer impaired, but because there is now a plan in place to address the problem. Honey, I didn't clean out the garage, but I have a plan. Check it off my list. What? Department of Natural Resources staff assessed 1,300 water body segments for the 2020 report, but that's less than the 1,422 assessed in 2018. Of those assessed for 2020, 61% of river and stream segments and 67% of lakes are impaired. That's up percentage-wise from 2018, when 57% of assessed waterways were impaired. Impaired, by the way, means waters don't meet water quality standards for their designated use, such as swimming, fishing, maintaining aquatic life, or serving as a drinking water source. And the list is a draft, with public comments being accepted through December. The number one impairment among lakes, reservoirs, and wetlands is algae, with toxic blooms largely fueled by fertilizer runoff from cropland. Bacteria was the top river and stream impairment. Another 96 stream or river segments were hit by fish kills, with 58 caused by livestock waste, pesticide, and fertilizer spills. But the impaired waters list doesn't tell the full story of agriculture's impact on water quality. That's because Iowa has no numeric water quality standards for nutrient pollution, nitrogen and phosphorus, in its waterways. A waterway could test high in nitrates, but in Iowa, that doesn't count as an impairment. The only nitrate standard that counts in Iowa is the federal limit for nitrate in drinking water sources. State regulators and agricultural interests have long delayed and resisted setting a water quality standard for nutrient pollution. After all, what we don't know can't make them look bad. In 2019, the Environmental Protection Commission rejected a petition urging it to set limits for nitrates, phosphorus, and other pollutants in Iowa lakes. Basically, the DNR argued that setting actual standards would lead to costly pollution cleanups. And how would it look if we actually found out how truly impaired our lakes are? Not good. But nutrients are the main event in the water quality debate. Iowa has a nutrient reduction strategy aimed at sharply reducing nitrates and phosphorus flowing from crops into Iowa waterways and onto the Gulf of Mexico. There, nutrient pollutants spawn an oxygen-sapping dead zone disrupting aquatic life. Pity the shrimpers of Louisiana. And suspend the column there. So we have time for At Liberty from Adam Sullivan. Iowa City charts aggressive, lonely path on police reform. Iowa City has positioned itself as the statewide leader on law enforcement reform, but in their quest for more police oversight and accountability, city leaders have been held back by state law. In hopes of bolstering local authority over law enforcement, the City Council recently adopted a set of admittedly lofty legislative priorities for the 2021 Iowa General Assembly. it is said to be a lonely battle for Iowa's most progressive city. Advocates have discussed the need for local governments to have a unified voice when advocating to legislators. So far, though, no other city has put forth a criminal and racial justice agenda as comprehensive or aggressive as Iowa City's. Legislative priorities approved by the City Council include uniform implicit bias and training requirements, decriminalization of small amounts of marijuana, automated data collection from traffic stops, statutory ban on disparate treatment by law enforcement, statewide review of community police boards, fund crisis intervention programs, and lift restrictions on specialty mental health care courts. By contrast, the League of Cities, which represents the city governments across the state, does not mention criminal justice reform in its annual legislative values, only vaguely referencing local control and public safety. The Metro Coalition, representing the largest cities, is not publishing a list of priorities. If ever there was a time for thoughtful collaboration between state and city leaders, this is it. The renewed racial justice movement this year is forcing local officials to take action on long-standing law enforcement concerns, but no one is quite sure where the limits of local power lie. Several cities are following Iowa City's lead in establishing citizen review boards of police, which Iowa City implemented more than 20 years ago. In theory, such boards can investigate and respond forcefully to police misconduct. In practice, though, review boards are significantly constrained by legal protections for government employees. Every city is going through this struggle of what are the state laws that restrict the various authorities these boards can have, Jeff Fruin, city manager, said at a recent meeting. Iowa City leaders hope the legislature will direct a study of police review board practices in Iowa and nationally in order to determine best practices. Collecting data at traffic stops and banning racial profiling, pieces of Iowa City's legislative priorities are echoed by recommendations from Governor Kim Reynolds' Criminal Justice Reform Committee. The group, led by Lieutenant Governor Adam Grigg, called for those measures in its recent report. Republicans controlling the Iowa legislature will at least give it a strong look. Reforming law enforcement is hard. It involves all levels of government, a huge body of established practices, resistance from police unions, and a wide range of other policy and legal issues. There is no surefire model to replicate. But decriminalizing marijuana is easy. It's a vetted and proven policy. Most states, including most of Iowa's neighbors, have already enacted some form of decriminalization. It's also necessary, as Iowa has some of the nation's worst racial disparities in drug enforcement. Again, suspending the column there. And turning to the letters to the editor and the editorial cartoon today by Joe Heller of Green Bay, Wisconsin. We have a man and a woman in welding masks standing in front of a table, and the woman's welding mask is over her face. The man's is lifted up. He is looking at what appears to be a Super Bowl trophy, although it says NFL Super Spreader Bowl, and the football atop the trophy has spikes sticking out of it in the manner of the coronavirus. And the man says, the way the season is going, the NFL is looking for a new design for the Lombardi Trophy. The first letter is from Rosemary Coleman of Cedar Rapids, who writes, returned wallet puts back belief in angels. To the person who found my wallet November 22nd, I extend my deepest gratitude. After retracing my route, enlisting my daughter's help, and checking with the places I've been, all paths had no luck. I'd given up hope in it getting returned. Early afternoon, I went to check if the mail had been delivered. It wasn't, but lo and behold, there was my wallet. My gloom quickly turned to joyous disbelief. There was a note, and yes, all of the contents were there. This has restored my belief that there are angels among us. At least I'm thankful for a human angel who did a very good deed. If I can't thank you in person, I at least hope you read this. Blessings to you and yours during this holiday season, and stay well. Rosemary Coleman of Cedar Rapids. Next, Robert Sprengler of Cedar Rapids writes, truth is a bitter pill for certain readers. Recently, there have been letters critical of columnist Todd Dorman. People have a right to their opinions, but those comments are off the mark. Dorman has a good understanding of what is happening. For example, when the legislature enacts huge tax cuts for corporations and wealthy Iowans, what happens? The rich get richer. Our schools suffer because of insufficient funding for K-12 education. Iowa once led the nation with its quality of education. Now, at best, we are in the middle of the pack. Our community colleges and universities are underfunded, with our universities losing the world-class standing they once had. Teachers and tenured professors are leaving the state due to lack of funding. Water quality in our lakes, rivers, and streams keeps deteriorating because of agricultural runoff with topsoil eroding. State parks are showing the result of inadequate funding and lack of proper maintenance. Recreational opportunities and good housing that would draw people to our state aren't on the state legislative radar. Climate change creates havoc in our state, causing floods, torrential rains, and storms. When will the legislature take corrective action? Dorman is correct when he says things like this are causing the brain drain from our state. A newspaper's obligation is to report news, not to ignore facts that might make some people uncomfortable. That was Robert Sprengler of Cedar Rapids. Next, K.E. Graber of Mount Vernon writes absentee voting worked well in Linn County. In Sunday's Gazette, November 29th, letter writer Darren Davenport suggested that voter fraud could be eliminated if the auditor's office would limit sending absentee ballot forms only to those who specifically requested them. I'm pleased to tell Mr. Davenport that is already the case. My husband and I voted absentee, but only after requesting them via written form. We received the ballots along with instructions on timelines for returning them. We drove to Cedar Rapids to personally deliver them. We were especially delighted to find that we could go online and follow our ballots through the voting process. Our thanks to the Linn County Auditor's Office for providing such excellent services that allowed us to vote absentee and to be assured that our votes counted. That was K.E. Graber of Mount Vernon. Next, Steve Patton of Cedar Rapids writes, Iowa Division isn't urban versus rural voters. The Gazette should investigate another aspect of the voting differences, urban-rural, in Iowa. Investigate the question, do you believe in God? Studies show that atheists voted for Joe Biden 71-29%, but this is not an urban-rural split. It is true in all areas, cities and towns. If the Gazette were to include some more of the liberal denominations in its study, it would be seen that the existing division is not rural versus urban. Iowans vote in agreement based on what they believe, no matter if a city, town, or farm. It's a spiritual issue. Steve Patton of Cedar Rapids. And Jim Olson, president of the Johnson County United Nations Association, writes, international efforts still needed to fight AIDS. World AIDS Day, which we mark December 1st, reminds us of the importance of international cooperation in combating infectious diseases. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports that 38 million people, including 1.2 million in the U.S., are living with AIDS, but the infection rate worldwide has declined by 40% since 1998. This downward trend is thanks in large part to UNAIDS, a collaboration of several UN agencies, and the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief initiated by President George W. Bush. Despite this progress, much remains to be done, since AIDS prevention and treatment does not adequately reach ethnic and minority groups that are disproportionately impacted. International cooperation and U.S. leadership are needed to end the COVID-19 pandemic. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have pledged to rejoin the World Health Organization, and perhaps the U.S. will take part in COVAX, the international initiative to develop COVID-19 vaccines. The incoming administration is to be commended for reasserting constructive U.S. leadership. Infectious diseases such as AIDS and COVID-19 do not respect national borders. Collective internal action is essential. It was Jim Olson, president of the Johnson County United Nations Association. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 6th, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn now to the obituaries. Virginia K. Newman, 78, of Amana, passed away after a short illness at Colonial Manor of Amana on Wednesday, December 2nd. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m. Monday, December 7th at St. John's Lutheran Church in Marengo, with Pastor Andrew Gray officiating. Family and friends may come from 10 a.m. until service time. Masks and social distancing are encouraged. Burial will be at the Amana Cemetery, Amana. Marjorie Wolf, known as Marge, 81, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday, December 3rd at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House, Hiawatha, after complications of a stroke. A celebration of life will take place at a later date. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids, is caring for Marge and her family. Roberta Klima, known as Bobby Bobby, age 83, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Mount Vernon, passed away peacefully with her family by her side on Thursday, December 3rd. Private family service, 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 8th. Friends and extended family are invited to watch the service via live stream. Michael H. Lusk, 60, of Cedar Rapids, went to be with the Lord on November 28th. A memorial service will be held at a later date, burial in Shiloh Cemetery, Hiawatha. John F. McInerney, 90, of Cedar Rapids, died on Friday, December 4th. A private family service and burial will be held. TN Funeral Home is serving the family. Fran Moore lived a full 79 years before passing away Thanksgiving morning. There will be a celebration of life for Fran at a later date. She is of Cedar Rapids. Carol H. Sheets, 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Wednesday, December 2nd. A private graveside service will take place at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Ron W. Rickleffs, 54, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Sunday evening, November 29th, at Unity Point St. Luke's Health. A celebration of Ron's life will be held at a future date when it is safe for his family and friends to gather to remember him. Mary Winder, 90, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, December 3rd. Private celebration of life services will be at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. Private family interment will be at a later date. Deborah Jean Carney, 67, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, December 3rd at St. Luke's Hospital. A private family celebration of life will be held at a later date. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids are in charge of arrangements. Marilyn Rhodes, 93, of Granger, Indiana, formerly of Keystone, passed peacefully of natural causes November 25th while residing at the hearth at Jude Creek, Granger, Indiana. Interment will be held at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton at a later date. Idella Roth Hogan passed away on Thursday, December 3rd, 2020, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Graveside services will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids with Pastor Mike Morgan of Marion Methodist Church as officiant. Arrangements by Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. Lila Lee Anderson of Independence, who is surprised to be living this long. Lila Lee Anderson, 92, was welcomed to her heavenly home at Buchanan County Health Center at Independence on December 3rd. Arrangements by Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service. Douglas Ray Kirk, 85, of Marion, Iowa, passed away Thursday, November 26th at Northbrook Manor in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic at this time, a private family committal service will take place at Alice Cemetery in rural Center Point, Iowa. A celebration of Doug's life reception will be planned for family and friends at a later date at Alice United Methodist Church in Center Point. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. June Zirkelbach, 96, of Monticello, died Tuesday evening, December 20th, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center following complications from COVID-19. A public visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Thursday, December 10th, at the Getch Funeral Home Monticello, where private family services will follow. Masks must be worn and fitted properly over the nose and mouth at all times to enter the funeral home. Social distancing needs to be practiced as well. Interment will be in the Oakwood Cemetery. Emily Woods, 36, of Walker, gained her wings on Tuesday, December 1st at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospice in Cedar Rapids following a brief illness. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Kathleen McElligott Long of Wallingford, Connecticut, passed away peacefully on November 25th at the age of 85 years in Wallingford. A mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. February 27th, 2021 at Holy Infant Church in Orange, Connecticut. An interment will follow at Orange Center Cemetery, Orange Center Road in Orange, Connecticut. Joe Doris Chandler, 93, of Waterloo, has passed away while living at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids Care Facility in Cedar Rapids. She passed away on Wednesday, November 25th from the COVID-19 virus. Private family graveside services were held at Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. A memorial service is being planned for the summer of 2021. Wanda Lee Clark Morrow of Las Vegas passed away on November 29th, 2020. A private burial service will take place on December 15th. Arrangements are by Palms Northwest Funeral Home. A celebration of life will take place at a later date in Las Vegas. Dorothy Lee Saunders, 89, of North Glen, Colorado, died November 26th at North Glen Heights Memory Care. She was born in Cedar Rapids. Due to COVID-19, no services will be held. Beverly J. Connock, known as Bev, of Des Moines, died on Wednesday, December 2nd at Scottish Rite Park, Des Moines. She passed peacefully in her sleep 5 days following her 93rd birthday. A graveside committal and funeral service will be held with immediate family at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, December 5th at Oakland Cemetery, Iowa City, Iowa. The Reverend Joseph Siss will be officiating. James Sauer, known as Jim, of Orlando, Florida, age 83, died Tuesday, October 20th at Advent Hospital in East Orlando, Orange County, Florida. He was born in Independence, Iowa, the son of Imogene Hoover Sauer and Arlie Sauer. David A. Schindel, 58, of Lake Barrington, Illinois, beloved husband and father and friend, died Monday, November 30th at Northwestern Memorial Hospital after a long, bravely fought battle with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, a celebration of his life will be held in summer 2021. Don R. Schmidt of Verona, Wisconsin, passed away peacefully on November 21st. He was born in Elkader. Due to current conditions, the family plans to delay services until the summer of 2021. Turning to the sports page, which is called The Final Score, we have a story entitled Flick of the Switch. Iowa 35, Illinois 21. Left for dead in the first quarter, Hawkeyes wake up and blitz Illini over final 45 minutes. By Jeff Johnson of the Gazette in Champaign. First, there was new Kirk. This season has been about soundbite Kirk. It was mask over the head Kirk in Saturday's game, literally. TV caught the Iowa football coach readjusting his long black Hawkeye face mask and leaving it toward the top of his head for a couple of seconds very early in Iowa's 35-21 win over Illinois at Memorial Stadium. This came after his team had just incurred quarterback Spencer Petras getting sacked on the second play of the game and then having to call a timeout before the third because there were only 10 guys on the field. An inauspicious beginning, an ugly one that lasted for a little more than a quarter as it turned quite befitting mask over the head Kirk. Who would want to watch the way the Hawkeyes were playing? It was rough there for a while, Farron said. Then Iowa finally began playing the football it has the past month, sidestepping into a 14-0 deficit and going on to post its fifth straight victory. The Hawkeyes, 5-2, conclude this convoluted COVID-19 regular season next week at home against Wisconsin, with a Champions Week encounter against someone, quite possibly Indiana, in 2 weeks somewhere. We knew coming in here that road games are tough, Farron said. Illinois has been playing good football with two straight wins and looked really good last time out in a 41-23 win over Nebraska. We certainly had a lot of respect for them. It's great to leave here with a victory, our fifth straight victory, our fifth Big Ten win. Oh, the start of this game for Iowa. Its opening three and out was followed by a 70-yard TD drive for Illinois and a quick 7-0 Illini lead. When receiver Josh Imtorbebe's initially ruled non-catch was reversed and video reviewed into a 12-yard touchdown snag, Illinois went up 14-0 just 1 minute and 30 seconds into the second quarter. It was the largest deficit Iowa has faced this season, the first time it trailed at the break since last year's Holiday Bowl. We were not playing good team football, Farron said. But then everything completely flipped. Iowa's impotent offense finally got going thanks in part to good field position its revitalized defense kept giving it. A Petras to Sam Laporte touchdown was followed by two Keith Duncan field goals, making it a 14-13 game of the half. The Hawkeyes picked up a defensive stop to begin the third quarter and followed with a 70-yard scoring drive of their own to go ahead for good, 21-14. Iowa's run reached 35 unanswered points eventually. A streak only ended when Illinois, 2-4, got a touchdown against Iowa's reserves with 24 seconds left. Going down 14-0 is never good, Laporta said. We were spinning our wheels. We weren't getting anything going. That first touchdown that jump-started us was huge. From there, we just took off. The final yardage total was Iowa 424, Illinois 348, with 75 of those yards again coming on the Illinois' final possession. Coach Farron says it all the time, that we're at our best when we're playing complimentary football, Petras said. The defense did a great job of getting us good field position. It kind of got things going. Give credit to our defense. They had a great game. We kind of feed off each other's energy. And by the numbers, Iowa has won 5 straight Big Ten games for the first time since winning all 8 in 2015 and the 2016 league opener. 14, Iowa came back to win after a 14-point deficit for the first time since beating Michigan 24-21 on November 23, 2013. After trailing 21-7, it's the first time the Hawkeyes did it on the road since November 3, 2007, against Northwestern when they won 28-17 after falling behind 14-0. And 396, Iowa gained 396 yards of offense in the final three quarters after managing just 28 in the opening frame. Illinois had 107 yards of offense in the first 15 minutes and 241 in the final 45. And then the Cyclones. Iowa State 42, West Virginia 6. Historic and euphoric. Finishing atop the Big 12 is fresh, fun, and a program first, but the Cyclones want more. By Maklas of the Gazette in Ames. This wasn't just securing outright first place in Big 12 conference football. The first football first place Iowa State has ever secured in the lifetimes of you or anyone you know. This was the Cyclones taking an axe to the door of the room containing first place, smashing it to splinters with great efficiency, having a grand old time doing it, and leaving no doubt about what it came out to achieve Saturday and across its 9-game conference season. This was supposed to be a contest, something for the Cyclones to approach with caution. Though number 9 in the college football playoff rankings, they were favored by only a touchdown over unranked West Virginia at Jack Trice Stadium. Understandably, the national college football talking head said Saturday morning that Iowa State would win against a Mountaineers team that had been outgaining its foes by 169 yards per game, but it would be hard-earned. But this was no contest. This was a 42-6 Iowa State win that showed how the Cyclones have gotten more menacing as the season gets older. This is a program that has not only found its footing, but has done some trampling. It closed the book on the conference regular season with an 8-1 record, playing everyone in the league and losing only by a field goal at Oklahoma State. We didn't set out to be the regular season champs or be 8-1, 8-2, Iowa State tight end Charlie Keeler said. Yeah, it's a great win. We're happy we're glad to send the seniors off the way we did, but we've still got games left to play. Cyclones coach Matt Campbell said the postgame reaction in his team's locker room was subdued. Obviously, Campbell said, this team's proud of what it's been able to do, and there was certainly a lot of celebration towards our seniors, but I think there's also a sense of understanding that there's more football left to be played. If we want to continue to move forward, then we're going to have to learn from tonight and then continue to get ourselves back in the habit of moving forward. He'll surely forgive his team's fans if they allow themselves to bask in the best regular season in school history, a team with really good players. Iowa State has the Big 12's best running back in Breece Hall, 153 total yards. It may have the league's best quarterback in Brock Purdy, and it may have the conference's best defense. Statistically, West Virginia had the league's number one defense before Saturday. Then it gave up 483 yards and 6 touchdowns to Purdy and the Cyclones. I think I'm just playing my game as far as not overthinking things, Purdy said. Keeping it simple, trusting what the coaches are calling, and understanding I've got really good guys around me. And streaks are still alive for the Hawkeyes in Iowa women's basketball by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Caitlin Clark isn't going to resemble an instant All-American every game. The offense isn't going to hum smoothly all of the time. Iowa City had some clunky stretches Saturday, but because of the opponent and their sight, they didn't prove disastrous. We showed our youth today, I thought, Coach Lisa Bluter said after the Hawkeyes held a serve against Wisconsin, 85-78 in the Big Ten women's basketball opener at Carver Hawkeye Arena. Iowa, 3-0 overall and 1-0 in the Big Ten, won its 38th straight game at Carver and handled the Badgers for the 23rd straight time. This game didn't go exactly as we planned, junior post Monica Cesano said. This is a young team, but we came together at the end. Wisconsin, 1-1 and 0-1, rallied from a 14-point first-half deficit to forge a 41-41 deadlock with 8 minutes left in the third quarter, but the Hawkeyes answered and gradually pulled away. It was 61-51 by the end of the third quarter, and a 9-0 run early in the fourth period extended the margin to 70-53. Iowa led to 76-58 before the Badgers made a closing push. Clark led the Hawkeyes with 23 points, but wasn't as sharp as she had been in the first two games. The freshman forced the action at times, shooting 8 of 23 from the field. I don't think Wisconsin did anything special against her. I just think Caitlin took herself out of her shooting percentage today, Bluter said. Turning to the time machine in the Iowa Today section, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Mary Snyder. During Depression, Marion woman started a cab company, drove for 32 years. By Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Marion cab driver Mary Snyder grew up in Cedar Rapids and loved to tell about her kindergarten days at Jackson Elementary, where she and Mamie Dowd were friends and had tea parties together. Mamie would grow up to marry Dwight D. Eisenhower and become the nation's first lady in 1953. When the Great Depression hit, Snyder lost her job at the Ford garage in Marion. When she couldn't find another job, she decided to go into business for herself. She owned a car, so she applied for a chauffeur's license and turned her car into a taxi in 1932. She soon partnered with Ann Jordan, and the pair formed the independent Mary Ann, that's M-A-R-I-A-N, cab company with their two vehicles. The name reflected their names and not Marion, the city, as some assumed. They did well enough to buy their own office building at 623 12th Street in Marion. The women did not confine their taxi fares to Marion or even Iowa. In 1937, Jordan told a reporter, she and Snyder had made trips to Nebraska, Des Moines, Minneapolis, and one trip to the World's Fair in Chicago. Marion's train depot welcomed two passenger trains a day, and one of Mary Ann's cabs was always there to meet them. Snyder and Jordan noted that women passengers were delighted to have a woman cab driver. Men seemed to be surprised. Were they nervous being alone with male passengers? No, Snyder said. I always kept a rolling pin and a box of red pepper under my car seat. I was left-handed, so I could drive with my right hand and reach the rolling pin and pepper box with my left. Jordan said she was once frightened when she had picked up a nighttime fare. The man wanted a ride into Cedar Rapids and started talking about how he knew the notorious gangster John Dillinger, calling him a fine fellow. The two women each logged about 45,000 miles a year in their taxis. Jordan retired in 1942 and moved to Orange, California. Snyder continued driving the remaining Mary Ann cab. In 1954, Clyde Dawson began running four cabs out of his black and white company, two of them driven by owners. The two companies were exclusive in Marion. Cedar Rapids cab companies were barred from operating out of Marion. They were allowed only to drop off passengers at the Milwaukee depot. Snyder added school bus driving to her repertoire, hauling kids for St. Joseph's Parochial School in the mornings. Starting at 7:45 a.m., someone else took the afternoon routes. She suffered a stroke in 1958, landing her in Mercy Hospital for 8 weeks before she went back to driving her cab. When President Dwight and Mamie Eisenhower were in Linn County in 1958 for the National Corn Picking Contest, the First Lady visited Jackson School in Cedar Rapids, which she had attended in 1903. Mamie Eisenhower had sent a note to Snyder saying she was sorry she wouldn't have time for a visit while in Iowa. Snyder decided to go see her childhood friend anyway. When Mamie emerged from Jackson, Snyder was there with other former schoolmates to shake her hand. Snyder also thanked Mamie for a photo the First Lady had sent when Snyder had been hospitalized. In 1961, Snyder's taxi was taken from her at gunpoint. It was found 4 days later in Arkansas. Snyder had picked up a man in Marion who wanted a ride to Winthrop, about 35 miles to the north in Buchanan County. When they arrived, the man forced Snyder out of the cab. He then drove the cab to a farm where he had worked to pick up his belongings, then drove to Minnesota and South Dakota before heading to Arkansas. When Snyder finally got her taxi back, February 17th, she said it was in good condition. He had even changed the oil. He also put 1,374 miles on the cab. After driving a cab for 32 years, Snyder sold the Marianne taxi to S.F. Tichot in 1964, and the name was changed in 1966 to Tex Taxi. Snyder suffered two more strokes, though she remained active, living the rest of her life at Winslow House Care Center in Marion, entertaining the residents by playing her harmonica and telling tales of her life as an Iowa taxi driver. She died June 24, 1978, at age 84. And from the books page, author profile of Tom Cook, Time to Step Up. Retired professor writes book about young boy with clubfoot. This is written by Rob Klein, correspondent. Tom Cook's career in medicine has taken him all around the world, including Nigeria, where the experiences of one particular 8-year-old boy who had been born with a skeletal birth defect known as clubfoot made a deep impression on him. Cook, in collaboration with Iowa City artist Joe Myers Walker, has fictionalized that boy's story in Lucky's Feet, a beautiful children's book. An emeritus faculty member at the University of Iowa, Cook has spent his, perhaps inaptly named, retirement working for the UI College of Medicine and the Ponseti International Association. The association continues and advances the pioneering work of Dr. Ignacio Ponseti, who developed the Ponseti Method, a non-surgical approach to treating clubfoot that has improved the lives of countless individuals born with clubfoot at the University of Iowa. The story of the young boy in Nigeria and the doctor who treated him, Dr. Olayinka Adegbehengbe, who is credited as co-author of Lucky's Feet, had long been part of Cook's teaching and advocacy. In fact, the story appears at the beginning of Cook's previous book, Clubfoot, The Quest for a Better Life for Millions of Children. In January, Cook had a realization. "This is a story that's good enough to be its own story," he said in an interview over Zoom. He immediately got to work writing late into the night and completed a first draft in a single sitting. Over the next couple of months, he polished the story of Lucky, a boy who lives with his grandmother because his father cannot come to terms with his disability. Offered the opportunity for her grandson to undergo corrective treatment, the grandmother agrees, and Lucky's life is transformed. Lucky narrates his own story, including clear descriptions of his treatment in language that is appropriate for his age. Cook set out to find an artist for his project, knowing that if his book was accepted by a traditional publishing house, he would be paired with an artist of its choosing rather than his. So he sidestepped the children's book industry, a decision that offered an additional advantage in terms of getting his book out to the public. "If you're a first-time author in your 70s," he said, "nobody wants to talk with you about anything. They think your creative juices are long gone. I guess I was too impatient to play that game." In Myers Walker, he found the perfect collaborator, and as it would turn out, she had an excellent reason to sign on to the project. In late June, around the time Cook reached out to her, she received a positive COVID diagnosis. Her symptoms, thankfully, were not dire, and she credits the project with helping her get through the illness. "This whole thing was a lifesaver," she said in the Zoom conversation, "because all I could do was stay in and paint and sleep and paint. This story got me outside of myself." And paint she did, completing 36 watercolors by mid-August, a remarkable accomplishment made all the more impressive by the technical detail the book required. Getting the portrayal of Lucky's treatment right on the page was extremely important to both Cook and Myers Walker, and that required a deep dive into the Ponseti method and a high level of stick-to-itiveness. "We had multiple versions of those paintings," Myers Walker explained. "They were medical illustrations in a sense." In addition to Lucky himself and the medical professionals who changed his life, Myers Walker was particularly drawn to the character of the grandmother. "The grandmother became my hero because I'm a grandmother," she explained. "She could see beyond this disability. Caring for Lucky gave her purpose. As I painted, I really became the grandmother in a way." Cook discovered that another set of characters were particularly appealing to young people. He asked his 10-year-old granddaughter to read the book and write down her answers to a series of questions. In answer to, "What is the best thing about this book?" she wrote, "The chickens." And indeed, the book is filled with chickens, a testament to Myers Walker's thinking about what might appeal to children and also to her insight into what a boy whose disability causes him to crawl along the ground would see from his vantage point. Cook and Myers Walker said they have been delighted with the book's early reception. They have heard from school librarians that Lucky's Feet is likely to have a ripple effect, helping students develop empathy for others with disabilities and helping those with disabilities and their families see a little bit of their own story and Lucky's experiences and the resilience of his family. Lucky's Feet is available from www.clubfootsolutions.org, as well as from area retailers, including Prairie Lights and Iowa Artisans Gallery in downtown Iowa City. Some of the original paintings for the book are also for sale at Iowa Artisans Gallery. Proceeds from book sales and from sales of the art will be donated to support the treatment of children born with clubfoot. Cook also has narrated the book and posted it to YouTube, complete with illustrations. And that brings us to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 6th, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. You can listen to our recordings anytime at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.